When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 87. I'm your host, Will Evans, and today I'm heading over the border to sunny Shropshire to talk to farmer and co-founder of the small robot company, Sam Watson-Jones. Sam, how are you?
Good, Will. Good to speak to you.
You too. And how was your journey this morning? Because you are a London to farm commuter.
I am. Travelling up on a Monday morning from South West London back up to the family farm in Shropshire. It was fine this morning. Thank you very much.
Good. No delays?
Slight delays, but nothing too serious. No, it was all right. All okay.
Good. And the farm's in near Newport, Shropshire. Is that where you grew up?
Yep. This is where I grew up, yeah. My family's been here for I'm the fourth generation. Okay. So our family came here in the 40s.
Yeah.
We actually came from just over the Welsh border, just near where you are, actually slightly further south.
Okay.
In the sort of early 1900s, we were hill farmers around there, and then we came over just before in the 20s as tenant farmers in Shropshire to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And then, this is a sign of how different farming was. My great-grandfather was a tenant farmer, and he made enough money from being a tenant farmer that he was able to buy each of his sons a 600-acre farm. He had three sons, and we're actually the only branch of the family that's still in the same spot and still going with that. So yeah.
Okay. So there's a farm that area, for people who don't know, it's mostly arable crops around there.
It is, yeah. Fairly flat, mm-hmm. sandy soil. Good arable area. We're 1,200 acres now, so we're 600 to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where sort of the story starts really for me, because so my grandfather added 300 acres and my dad added 300 acres, and then when it came to my turn, it was pretty clear that adding 300 acres was going to be tricky. So I started thinking about what else my contribution to the family business could be.
Yeah, okay. So before we get into that then, Sam, have you heard of the AFTP, the Agri-Food Training Partnership?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, it is a partnership between six leading UK universities and the bridge between industry and academia, translating cutting-edge academic research into applied industry expertise. Starting now, listeners could be doing online part-time courses in subjects as interesting and diverse as grassland systems, ruminant health and welfare, ruminant nutrition, agro-ecosystem services, soil management, or water and agriculture. And you, Sam, especially, you'll know how important and relevant they are. You can find all these courses on aftp.co.uk/podcast, and there's currently 25% off poultry health online for the first five places only. So if you're interested, get your asses into gear. This course will reflect developments in poultry health and the changing areas of veterinary and technical expertise within it. Also, there's a free course, Trust in Food, Understanding Food Supply Systems, that starts on 22nd of October and explores the challenges and responsibilities of different people in the food system, including the role of the consumer. You will leave the course, know more about where your food comes from, how you can make a difference in the food supply chain, and you can find more out about that at www.futurelearn.com /courses/food-supply-systems. Okay. Sam, despite...
Good line, and I was hoping it was going to be Will.
I did all that in one breath. Sam, despite living just a few miles down the road from the greatest agricultural university in the world, you went to study English literature at Newcastle instead.
That's right. Yeah, I did. I did. So, yeah, so I was 18. I didn't want to be a farmer when I was 18. Mm-hmm. Not really sure why, other than I suppose my experience of farming was sitting on the back of a tater grader mucking out the cows and things like that. We used to have cows back in the day, and I just thought I wanted to try and do a bit more. So I just did what I was good at school. Really, there was no further thought beyond that. Mm-hmm. Went to Newcastle, did English literature, really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
actually. Over the course of being at Newcastle, I got roped into the Newcastle Agric rugby team.
Okay.
And never looked back. Ended up spending quite a lot of time with some farmers, some farmers' sons, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it gradually, I suppose, dawned on me the potential to be your own boss, to have control over your own future. And it was interesting to me how they all had a really clear idea of what they were going to do with their life and what their purpose was. And that was something that lots of my other friends didn't have. So there was something quite impressive about that. And I suppose by the end of that 3 years, and a few cross-dress pub calls later, I was confirmed as a, you know, I knew I wanted to be a farmer by the end of that 3 years.
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and not through doing agriculture either. You know, obviously I didn't change courses. I completed my English literature course. And it just sort of became clear in my head that's what I wanted to do. To contribute to the family business. The idea of it being this continuity of this family business, where lots have gone on before me, I wanted to be part of making sure that lots goes on after me.
Mm. Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's, maybe you just needed that time away, I suppose, for it to become clear to you, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. I knew that. I didn't want to go. So one thing I disagreed with that some of my friends were doing was that they were, literally they were just doing this 3 years as they had to just get off the farm. Mm-hmm. You know, dad was making them get off the farm, go and get your degree and come straight back. Mm-hmm. And I disagreed with that. Mm-hmm. I thought, I think there's a big world out there, and I think it's easy to get isolated both geographically but also in your thinking. Mm. if you do that. So I was very clear that I wanted to get away and I suppose prove that I could have a different career if I wanted to. So that I wasn't reliant on the farm. And also I wanted to get away and do something that broadened my business experience really. Gave me a broader understanding beyond farming. And so I wanted to. I gave myself 5 years actually after university to go and do something different.
So you had a very clear plan that you wanted 5 years away, and then you would go back to the farm. That was.
Yeah, it wasn't. It turned out to be 5 years. It wasn't set in stone at the start that it was going to be 5 years. Uh-huh. I did various things. The first thing I did was. Teach first. So that was it's 2 years teaching in a city school. Mm-hmm. Which is as different to life in Shropshire as you can possibly get. Yeah. So I was teaching English at Wembley High Technology College.
Okay.
So I was teaching something like 150 kids a week. I think I taught two white British kids, and almost everyone else was a first generation immigrants. Some of them were second generation immigrants. But it was, you know, there were something like 95 different languages spoken in the school. You know, just a massive eye-opener, just a completely different world. Kids who come from a totally different background and didn't have any of the, you know, the advantages that I had growing up. And it's a great program, actually. For those who don't know about Teach First, they should look it up. It's a great program, and it is by some distance the hardest thing I've ever done. Mm. And I'll definitely include Small Robot Company in that as well. we'll come on to talk about that. But yeah.
I mean, I guess it's for people listening, it might not realize Wembley, that's part of London, it's quite economically deprived as well, isn't it? It must have been, you know, it's quite a tough part of London, isn't it?
Yeah, so it is a tough part of London. And so one of the criteria for schools qualifying to be part of the Teach First program, which is essentially, it's like a fast track teaching program. So I left university in the May of 2006. And then we did a really, really intensive teacher training program through the summer. Mm-hmm. And then on September the 1st or 2nd, whatever it was, of 2006, so 5 months later, I was on my own at the front of a class, 35 kids in front of me, with a full teaching timetable to go at. Yeah. And it's one of the criteria for being part of the Teach First school program is that 25% of the kids have to be eligible for free school meals, which is essentially that their income level is low enough to warrant additional support from the government to buy their school lunch.
Sure.
And a lot of these kids, that was the only meal they were getting. It was the only decent meal they were getting all day. Yeah. You know, it's just parents who either were just too busy or weren't supportive or, you know, were absent mentally or physically. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these kids, you know, it's tough to see that. You know, 12-year-olds essentially fending for themselves. And then you start to understand, you know, why there's behavior issues. And you see kids who really want to progress themselves and they're finding it difficult for lots of reasons. It was a great experience.
Did you find it rewarding as well?
Yeah, really, really rewarding. It's all about relationships.
Yeah.
That thing. So where I went to school, which I went to private school, and essentially when the adult walked into the room, you immediately gave them respect. And that's not the case at Wembley High. When you walk into the room, you have to prove your worth to these kids, because a lot of them have been let down by adults throughout their entire lives. And so you have to over time build a relationship and show you don't just immediately get respect. You have to show that you are worth it. And the best thing that I did in my time there was actually bringing a bit of farming to them. So there was this tiny little square in the middle of the buildings, which was just a patch of fairly dead grass. It was maybe 5 meters by 5 meters. And we dug it up and set up a veg patch in the middle of the school, and it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, because the kids, just the connection to, well, just the idea of being able to do something energetic but useful, the idea of being able to just put something in the ground and see it grow was incredible for them. We grew, you know, just grew easy things like, you know, we just grew some lettuce because it would grow quickly.
Yeah.
And then we came to harvesting this lettuce, and we were cutting it up, and they were like, "But sir, we can't eat this lettuce, can we?" And but it's all covered in dirt. So, well, that is where lettuce comes from.
Yeah.
We just had no connection to where their food came from, no concept of it at all.
Yeah.
So we had a group of maybe 10 kids who really got into this, And then the culmination of the project was we did a trip back up to the farm. And it was even to driving up from Northwest London to Shropshire in the minibus with these kids. It was just brilliant.
Okay.
So we drove past Birmingham as you do on the motorway, and they had no concept that there was a city that big outside of London.
Okay.
These were kids who lived, 100 yards away from a tube stop, and had never been into central London and had never been out of London. It's amazing how isolated they were. Just a massive eye-opener getting them up here and just showing them how farm worked. And it was great. Really, really good experience.
Must have been a fantastic thing to be involved in.
So then that led on to the next year after Artitudes First, I did something called Jamie's Farm. So I was something like employee two or employee three, which is it. And Jamie's Farm is a similar thing. So a friend from Teach First who had this concept of taking kids, and particularly kids who had the most challenging behaviour issues, mm-hmm. and taking them out of that environment and giving them a week-long residential experience on his farm just outside Bath.
Okay.
I did that for a year. I'm not formally involved in that anymore, but that has gone on from strength to strength, and they have now, I think, four different sites across the country.
Okay.
And again, for people who haven't heard of it, please look it up, jamiesfarm.org.uk, I believe.
Yeah, okay.
But a brilliant charity, doing some really good work with some tough kids.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so at that stage, when you were doing that, you worked in the school and then you worked there, did you... is that something that, do you think, dealing with so many different kids and well, not just the kids, all the adults involved as well, that's sort of stood you in good stead for where you are now?
Yeah, it does, because two reasons, really. As I said, it was in terms of workload and in terms of how challenging it was, it was the most challenging thing that I've ever done. I would typically be up at five to travel into school. I'd then be in school sort of half seven till six. I'd then go home, and then I'd have a bit of food and I'd start work again at about eight. I'd work through till about 11 o'clock, and then I'd press repeat and did that for 2 years.
Yeah.
And so no matter how hard work gets now, I always know I've got more to. I can push myself harder if I need to.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, it's just about the comfort of thinking on your feet and speaking to people.
Mm.
And as you get challenged, if you don't say something clearly to a group of kids like that, then they tell you about it, because they either directly tell you about it, or the task that you set them to do just goes into absolute chaos because you haven't been clear about what you want them to do. And you have to think on your feet, and you have to change stuff as you go, and you have to have absolute control over yourself and obviously over the people you're talking to, and you've got to be really engaging. And I have no worries at all about standing in front of people and talking, which is something that in later life has become extremely useful. Those are the two main things, really.
Okay. So where did you go from there then after Jamie's Farm?
So then Teach First is very heavily sponsored by big businesses, and they almost provide like a fast track through their recruiting system. Big accountancy firms, big consultancy firms in the city, big investment banks. I joined Accenture, which is a global management consultancy firm.
Mm-hmm.
Technology focused, and this was the bit where I was thinking that I was going to get some fairly broad business experience in this role. Actually turned out to be a lot more specialized than I thought it would be.
Okay.
um, it was really interesting working with some very intelligent, very very highly qualified people, sure. and working in teams that are just operating at a really high level. And I enjoyed it for what it was worth. I was glad to leave by the time I did. And when I sort of had enough of that, I was either married or very close to being married by this stage, and so sort of just discussed with my wife, well, what we're going to do. I feel like I need to move on from Accenture. And discussion came, well, we're back to the farm at some point, so it may as well be now. And so it did. That was 2011. So what was I then? I was 20. My maths isn't very good. 25, 26. And we did that.
So the prodigal son returned.
The prodigal son returned.
So what was, when you returned to the farm, what was going on the farm there? What different enterprises have you got going on?
So we had reasonably recently, before I came back, gone out of cows and gone into broiler chickens. So we had 150 cow dairy unit. Mm-hmm. We sold up and went into broiler chickens, growing broilers for Moy Park.
Okay.
We were one of the sort of early people in on that. And that had happened in 2007 to 2008.
Okay.
So that had been a big decision that I'd been semi-involved with in discussing with Dad.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very much Dad's decision. You know, that was progressing and going well. We were growing 150 acres of potatoes, and then the rest was combinable crops.
Okay.
And that was the mix at the time.
Okay. So what's, since you returned then, what changes have you made? Made quite a few.
So it quite quickly became clear to me that we needed to change something about where the income was coming from in farming. In terms of the mix of the business. And I suppose because of the background, I never really thought of us as a farm. I thought of us as a family business. We happened to be involved in farming.
Yeah.
But everything, I was very clear that everything had to stack up under its own steam.
Mm-hmm.
And I could certainly see that some of the returns on capital that we were getting for the act of farming the land, combinable crops and potatoes was not really there.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my focus was around diversifying it. So keeping that stuff going, but bringing in a more diverse range of income streams, so that when times weren't good in farming, which we know there were always going to be years where that happens, we weren't so reliant on it. It wasn't having such a dramatic effect on the family finances, which it was,
mm-hmm.
particularly the way we were farming potatoes, which was not much on contract. You know, some good years, but some really bad years as well.
Mm-hmm.
So quite a high risk way of doing things.
Okay.
So diversification started with renewables. So we went into doing some biomass boilers for our chicken sheds, which was good and has worked out really well. We put some solar panels on the chicken moves as well, and that's, you know, that's worked out well. It was, mm-hmm. we were quite early into that,
yeah.
so the cost was quite high, but the returns were good.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suppose the big contribution that I have made has been to get us to look off farm for income and for ways of growing the business. Because I suppose one of the key issues that we have, and this I would say applies to all farming businesses really, is that the revenue streams that we have within farming are not growing year on year. So, you know, unless we're dramatically increasing the land area that we're farming, which is an expensive undertaking to do, whether you're renting or buying.
Yeah.
You know, we knew what our wheat income was going to be and roughly what our potato income was going to be, but we couldn't reliably say that 5 years down the line, you know, it was going to be 15 or 20% higher. Mm-hmm. But we could say that the costs underneath, so, you know, the costs incurred to generate those revenues probably would increase. Mm-hmm. You know, we're probably going to increase our labour costs every year. Our fuel costs are probably going to increase every year. Our machinery costs are going to increase every year. So, you know, the fundamentals of that don't really stack up. And this is closely tied to the stuff that we are doing with the small robot company. But there are other businesses, other sectors where that doesn't apply, where there is the opportunity to grow it year on year. So we started, and the other thing was around risk as well. So it was, you know, if on the one hand we have a load of capital tied up, if you like, in farmland, and that's pretty low risk.
Yeah.
I wanted to think about the family business almost like you would think about an investment portfolio. So if you have a very low risk asset at one end, what can you do that potentially is maybe slightly higher risk but has some higher returns at the other end, and what can you do in the middle? Mm-hmm. So the first move was around property. So I've got a friend who's a builder, and we set up this development partnership where essentially we were funding the development of some houses. Mm-hmm. And he was doing all the work, and that's worked really well, and we're still involved in that. And then we went a step further last year, and so this is you know, using land as collateral to raise debt, and then investing that debt in other stuff, which is diversifying the business. And then we went a step further, and we bought a manufacturing business last year. So a good old fashioned Dudley steel bashing business.
Okay.
And that's been great. So that was a partnership with my cousin, we have definitely the potential to grow that business, and grow, you know, a whole separate arm of the business, if you like, that has nothing to do with farming, which can potentially support the growth of the business. And the long term aim is that we have a growing business that meets the needs of the family, but also that we look after this generational asset. You know, we have to take decisions now that hopefully help the farm to not only exist but be better in the future. Mm. And this is not necessarily the right way for everyone, but it's just based on my interests and my experience off the farm have led me to thinking down this route.
Yeah.
And then the one final area that I dabbled in a bit around this area was thinking, well, okay, so what's the sort of the highest risk but potentially highest return investment that we could get involved with? And so at a very small level, I got involved in some angel investing. So taking very small stakes in startup companies, technology startup companies, but which have the potential to grow enormously. And I did this. So I did this on an education focused technology accelerator to start with. So so this is it's like a Dragon's Den type thing. So there's a group of investors who club their money together, and then maybe 15 companies come and pitch, and we pick four or five to go through the accelerator program, and we all take a small stake in it. And then that provides some seed funding for these guys, who then hopefully go on and grow the business so that it's something impressive. And what was great about that was, for the first time, starting to think of myself as an entrepreneur. Being around other experienced entrepreneurs. So some of these, my co-investors were people who'd built and sold companies and done some really exciting things, and they just had this attitude of, you know, seeing a problem or something that needed fixing in the world, and then just starting a company to go and make it happen. And so they started to push me. What about farming? What's the technology play going to be in farming? How does farming need to change? And when they initially asked that question, I didn't really have an answer. Mm-hmm. And this was 2014, 2015 for reference. And I started to think about it. And that's when the thinking sort of led me towards looking at the stuff that they were doing at Harper, which, as I said, is just 3 miles down the road. Mm-hmm. And then through some conversations with some people working there, namely Simon Blackmore, who had this great concept of farming should be different. And yeah. What if farming wasn't based on a tractor-led system? What if it was based on a robot-led system? What would the future of farming look like if that was the case? And I found this completely inspiring. And it just fit into that mindset of, you know, there is a problem here. There is a big problem around how we use machinery and how we think about our farm businesses. And everything around how we operate our businesses is to make the machinery as efficient as possible. It's not to make the farmers productive in terms of yield as possible. It's not to make the farmers as profitable as possible, even. It's around efficient use of the machinery. And it just started to make sense to me. But there was a key sentence that Simon Blackmore said, which was, you know, this, the basic technology to do this, to have farming operated by small smart machines exists. And the reason that it's not widespread is that the incumbent machinery manufacturers, the big players in this area, are not interested in it existing because it's so cannibalizing to their existing businesses. And there is a space between what exists in universities, what is theoretically or proven to be possible at a small scale, and what exists at the commercial scale on farms. And he said that space needs to be filled by an entrepreneur.
Okay.
And I just said, well, that's what I want to be.
Eureka.
I want to fill. Exactly. Yeah, it really, really was. And I can remember you know, the driving back from Harper, the very short drive back, thinking, I just have to do this. I can't not do this. And this is, everything has been leading up to this point. It really did feel like that I, you know, had views on the future of farming that I could potentially articulate to farmers and get them to buy into this and get other people who knew nothing about farming but knew lots about technology to buy into it too.
Okay.
And we could make this happen.
Okay. So how did, from there then, how did Small Robot Company come about?
So from there, Simon said, so there's this other guy who's come to talk to me about this, and his name is Ben Scott Robinson. So Ben is knows nothing about farming. He knows a little bit about farming now that I've spent 2 years trying to tutor him, but he knew nothing about farming.
Okay.
But he was an experienced entrepreneur. And he'd taken a couple of companies from startup to sale, and he'd really worked mainly in getting people to have designing really good experiences of brand new technology. So he was involved right at the early days of the internet. He was involved right at the early days of mobile technology.
Okay,
and it was all around designing a really good experience of this technology, and he had heard, I think, Simon Blackmore talking on Farming Today or something like that, and just said, I've just got to go and talk to this guy. He went and talked to him, and he said, well, you should really meet Sam, who's a farmer, and he shares a lot of the same views as you around how food production should be better. And so we met in January 2017, and we you know, over a coffee, we pretty quickly established that we came from very different backgrounds, but that we really clearly shared a vision for how to try and make farming better, to try and make it better for the environment, better for the farmer, and so a Small Robot Company was born. But I have to say that I have to give the credit to, well, I talked through the farming system, but I have to give the credit to the branding and the name and the way the system is named to Ben, and we can talk through that.
Yeah. Okay. So as a As a farmer yourself, and you must have talked lots and lots of other farmers about the idea and robotics and agriculture in general. What are farmers' concerns about the way we're doing things now, and what are they or we looking for with ideas such as yours?
So you're right that before we spent any money on this, we had to find out if farmers shared our view. Mm-hmm. So I spent 3 or 4 months travelling around near here, mm-hmm. Shropshire, Cheshire, Staffordshire, talking to as many farmers as would pick up the phone to me. Mm-hmm. I probably spoke to maybe 50 farmers in 3 months, 4 months. And basically, the first thing I started with was around costs. And I said, on our farm, we generate the same revenue per hectare as we did 25 years ago, which is true. So not, adjusted for inflation, the same actual pounds figure mm-hmm. As we did 25 years ago. But that's obviously worth a lot less than it was 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in terms of yield, we generate the same yield per hectare on average. Good years and bad years, but we couldn't honestly say that our average yield per hectare has increased mm-hmm. over the last 25 years. And they agreed with me on both of those points. And then the third point was around how we interact with the environment, with our current farming system. Mm-hmm. So using big heavy tractors causes lots of compaction. Mm-hmm. And because we cause lots of compaction, we have to go in with a cultivator, with a plow, and turn that soil over to reset it, if you like. Mm-hmm. And that costs a lot of energy, but it also causes a lot of damage. It kills a lot of worms, kills a lot of the beneficial microbiota that live in the soil. Certainly around us and in other areas as well, it enables a huge amount of soil erosion. Mm-hmm. So at the same time as I was having these conversations with farmers, I had a chat with a guy who used to work for my granddad who has lived next to the farm for 30 years. And he says that the field outside his farm is a foot to a foot and a half lower than it was when he bought the house. Wow. And that is sandy soil, but that is soil that is just every time we turn it over and there aren't roots in the soil, a bit of it, the winds come, a bit of it disappears. Every time the rain comes, a bit of it disappears. And that's an 80-acre field outside his house. Mm-hmm. That is an enormous amount of value that has disappeared from our farm forever. And so essentially, I sat down in farmers' kitchens and I said that. I said that stuff. So, my thesis was farming is failing in terms of productivity. We're not increasing yields year on year. It's failing in terms of profitability. We're generating the same revenue, but our margins are shrinking because our costs are increasing. And it's failing in terms of the environment. And then they agreed. They agreed on all three fronts. Almost unanimously, very, very few people who queried any of that. Mm-hmm. And then the next leap in my thinking then was the core reason is the machinery we use. It's the fact that we have a tractor, which is getting more expensive every year to run. But also every time we replace it, it's more expensive, it's bigger, it's more powerful, but it doesn't generate more profit. No. It just enables us to get across the field slightly quicker. But it hasn't. If it's gone up 10% in price, it hasn't enabled a 10% increase in profit. And the inaccuracy of the sprayer is the other key issue that we have in farming at the moment. So we know that it's widely accepted that only 60% of the fertilizer we apply to a crop actually gets taken up by the crop. 40% of it is wasted. Mm-hmm. So if we apply nitrogen and 40% of it it just sits in the soil or evaporates, that has a devastating impact on the wider environment. So on that particular note, there was a piece in The Economist a few weeks ago that said that act of inaccurately applying nitrogen fertilizer causes $800 billion of damage every year to marine habitats. So that is, nitrogen sits in the soil, rains come, washes into the watercourses, ends up in the mouths of rivers and things like that, where it causes a flush of algae, which smothers the marine habitats. Now, that is not because we don't have technology to apply that stuff more accurately. It's because we have a machine which has not been designed to do the job as accurately as possible. Mm-hmm. The machine, the spray that we have, is designed to get the man sitting in it across the field as quickly as possible, so that he can then go on and do something else. We have designed the system around making the machinery as efficient as possible. We have not designed the system around making the machinery as accurate as possible. And that's, frankly, well, we should be ashamed of ourselves. We need to do something better. And the suggestion is, so at this point, I'm starting to get a little bit more confrontational with the farmers and saying, what are we going to do about it? And the suggestion is, we need to build a series of small, smart machines that do this stuff more accurately. And that's where we come on to Tom, Dick and Harry. Can you tell you about Tom, Dick and Harry?
Yes, let's go into the practicalities of it a bit. Because, I guess people have seen pictures of robots, and they've maybe even seen pictures of your stuff. But let's talk about what they are and how the whole thing works.
Okay, so our suggestion is a better system would be using Tom, Dick and Harry. So Tom is a monitoring robot. So he goes out into the field and he monitors each individual plant in a field. Technically, absolutely achievable. And in fact, we can do this already. We at Small Robot Company can do this already. So a robot that routes itself autonomously and can take high quality data from every single plant in the field. That then gets communicated to Wilma. Now, Wilma is the boss of the three robots. She's the brains of the operation, if you like, and she's an artificial intelligence-driven operating system.
Okay.
So the data comes back in from the field from Tom, and this, so initially it's going to be plant data, ultimately it will also be soil data, so taking really granular soil data, so eventually measuring every square meter of soil in your field. Sending that into Wilma. Wilma interprets and analyzes this data and then helps the farmer to make a decision.
Okay.
This then gets communicated out to the other robots. So the first one is Dick. Dick is a micro-spraying and non-chemical weeding robot. So taking plant-level data from Tom, so understanding not broadly where diseases are, but exactly which plants have disease in them, and we can of course use infrared technology to see the presence of disease before a human eye can detect it.
We then
go out into the field and microdosing those plants with chemicals, with fertilizer, based on our analysis of what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And then non-chemical weeding is what it sounds like, so it's essentially killing weeds without using herbicides. So we're looking at electrical charges and we're looking at lasers to identify plants and then kill them without using a chemical.
So it literally literally does, as it's going along, it will literally identify a weed and laser it.
Possibly not as it's going along, but ultimately, yes.
Okay.
But initially, ID is carried out by Tom with really accurate location data around that. So we know exactly which plants he has looked at. And then in a separate operation, Dick goes out and recognizes those plants. So there will be plant recognition in there.
Okay.
And kills it. So the electrical charge, for example, this is technology not developed by a small robot company. This is developed by a company called Rootwave.
Mm-hmm.
So it's touching the weed with an arm, and then sending an electrical charge down through the weed, which basically boils the weed to death.
Wow. Okay.
That's what we're so that bit actually is our first focus at the moment.
Okay.
That's the bit we're going to focus on initially.
So,
and then the final part of the system is Harry, and Harry's a digital planter, so placing an individual seed in the ground. And varying the seed spacing and seed depth, again, based on artificial intelligence, so that we understand what is the perfect spacing for this particular plant for this particular target market based on the soil that you're planting it into, based on predictions for moisture levels over the next over the growing season, and predictions for market activity over the growing season. So making science the driving force behind how decisions are made.
Okay.
On farm.
So how much in practical terms then? Well, first of all, how do they cope with ground conditions, topography, working on slopes, anything like that? Is that all fairly easy to overcome?
Yeah. So that's probably. We're nearly there on that, but probably that's the challenge over the next 12 months is to make them that bit more robust and able to deal with a real variety of farming conditions.
Okay.
But it's really not impossible stuff to sort.
Okay.
The practicality of how this works for the farmer is that Tom, the monitoring robot, is basically on the farm. So this is through. So an important point here is that we're not selling the robots, so we're offering these through something called farming as a service. So basically, the farmers pay us a per hectare fee for using the robots. And the reason for this is to reduce the risk level to farmers. So they haven't got to find, you know, 200k kicking around in the cash flow to invest in some brand new robots.
Yeah.
They try us out on a small area to start with. If it works, it's great. They expand their coverage with us the following year, and if it doesn't, well, they haven't sold their sprayer, they haven't sold their drill. They haven't had to wholesale convert to a different farming system. They've tried something new out in a relatively low risk way.
Yeah. Okay. So most farmers don't have all their ground in one ring fence. You know, you'll have blocks around several different locations. How does that work? Is that just a matter of you're going to have to pick them up, put them in the truck?
So all of these robots will fit in the back of the smallest fit in the back of a transit van.
Yeah. Okay.
So basically, it'll be Tom, the monitoring robot, will be on your farm all the time, gathering data. 24 hours a day, every day, monitoring the fields. You'll have enough TOMs to be able to cover your whole farm in a week. Then the data is, as I said, analysed and processed by the operating system, Wilmer. And then Wilmer determines, with the farmer's input, when Dick and Harry are required on the farm. And then Dick and Harry will eventually probably be a modular robot. So a robot similar to a tractor in many respects, but much more lightweight, which is doing multiple jobs, and that will serve, you know, a few farms in a radius. And we've got to determine exactly what that radius is, but basically be a regional hub that will serve, you know. So for us, there's maybe a regional hub in North Shropshire that's serving maybe both Bangor on Dee and down to Newport,
okay.
But maybe a smaller area, maybe a smaller area than that.
Okay.
And then those robots just turn up on farm as and when they are needed.
Right. So how long? So, I mean, one of the reasons why machinery's got as big as it is just volume, isn't it? So people are maybe farming a lot of hectares, like say with drilling. So you're going to sow the seed. How much seed would they carry? I mean, how is it collected?
Yeah. So drilling, for example, the robot's going to carry maybe 2 hectares worth, something like that. We're trying to keep it as lightweight as we possibly can.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be a mobile collapsible hopper at the end of each field, so say a 10-ton hopper that sits on or near the headland, and the robot just trundles back, refills itself, and goes back out. So enough that hopper needs to be topped up, but enough for a robot to work through the night, basically.
Yeah, okay.
And then, you know, the next stage on from that might be some refueling robots. So one robot that's going up and down the field and another one that's going back and forth from the hopper, just to increase the efficiency on that.
Okay.
Keeping the weight fairly low is key, because then that widens the operating window.
Okay. And as they're working, say the heavens open, it starts lashing down with rain, they'll just realise that and they'll just stop and they'll just...
Yeah, exactly that. And of course, as you said, the operating window will be wider. Mm-hmm. So it'll be able to travel, you know, at or near field capacity. Mm-hmm. It will monitor what conditions are like, and it'll just stop when it needs to.
Okay. And as Tom gathers the data and sends it back to Wilma, presumably that as a farmer, you can just access all that information straight from your smartphone or computer. It's instantly there.
So that's the bit that we're building mm-hmm. at the moment. So our first farmer customers, which we have 20 people signed up to be our first customers already, mm-hmm. They're going to see first versions of this software in the next 2 or 3 months. But that's exactly right. So they'll be able to see stuff. And one of the key things that we need to determine, which we don't know the answer to yet, is what level of interaction do the farmers want? Mm. Do they still want to be involved in every decision? Are they happy to delegate some stuff to a small robot company and some stuff they still want to keep in house? Do they want to be physically moving the robots themselves, or do they want someone else to do it? And it'll probably vary farmer to farmer, and I think we'll be able to vary our service as well.
Yeah, okay. So is there anything, we've talked about everything that they will do, is there anything that they can't do in terms of establishing and growing a crop? I mean, what about tillage, for example, even if you want to just do some light tillage, is that something they can handle or not?
So not these ones. That's another area that we've got to look at.
Yeah.
So we're basing this on a no-till approach, mm-hmm. but we're not going to be evangelical about that. Okay. There may be certain fields that need cultivating or even ploughing or whatever.
Yeah.
And we'd still use tractors for that. Mm-hmm. Muck spreading is another one, mm-hmm. which we're not looking at the moment. Harvesting is the other obvious one. Mm-hmm. It's worth saying at this point that what we're focusing on first of all is wheat, and so wheat is our first target crop. Mm-hmm. We aren't designing a robotic combine harvester yet, but ultimately we will, and at that point we have the potential to completely redesign the countryside in a way that suits us. So if we can identify and then treat an entire combinable crop field of wheat or, you know, ultimately barley and oats and all seeds, whatever, mm-hmm. If we can do that at the plant level, then there is no reason, other than we haven't overcome the engineering hurdle yet, that we can't harvest the whole field on a plant-by-plant level.
Okay.
So again, getting further away from farming by averages and harvesting just the plants that are ready, just when they're ready, is one thing. But also the exciting implication of that is we could have multiple harvests in a single field. We know exactly where each plant is. We could have different varieties of wheat in the same field. We could have plants that are fixing nitrogen next to the plants that are using the nitrogen and so on and so forth. But you get away from, as I said before, designing the whole of the countryside to make the machinery as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
You no longer need big square fields with monocultures in them, because which is one of the main reasons that disease spreads so easily through arable crops. Mm-hmm. We would no longer need that. So it's not something we're doing right now. It's more robot company, but it's definitely something we will do at some point. And I am hugely excited about that because it, as I say, has the potential to totally change how we think about and manage our farms. What's equally exciting about it is that, you know, in my own tiny little brain, I'm probably only thinking of a tiny percentage of the possibility for that new farming system. And what's been great about being part of Small Robot Company is seeing these enormous brains from all sorts of different sectors, nothing to do with farming, coming and thinking about what we're doing and why we're doing it in that way, in a completely with a completely fresh perspective. And I think that I think we've got enormous potential in that area.
So it's precision farming on steroids then.
Yeah, it is.
What about people's jobs then? Because, and this must be something you get asked all the time. And I know I went to see the hands-free Hector in operation at Harper, and I posted a few pictures online afterwards, and I got all kinds of comments like, people sort of saying, well, that's really scary. You know, what's going to happen with people's jobs? What's going to happen to tractor drivers and things like that? What do you, how do you answer those kind of questions?
So, firstly, if we think of the industry perspective to start with, we're already operating in an industry where the jobs have disappeared, is the blunt truth.
Yeah.
You know, so on our farm, we used to employ 35 people on the arable side.
Mm-hmm.
We now employ two and a half. And that pattern has been replicated across the industry. There's not a huge number of jobs that are tied up into this.
Mm-hmm.
At the individual level, though, so there are still obviously individuals who are doing these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is that actually it's an opportunity to get those people working in ways that add value to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, a human being is not uniquely able to sit on a tractor and drive up and down the field. You know, that is something that a machine could do just as effectively, if not better.
Yeah.
But there are lots of things that human beings are uniquely able to do. So human beings will be better at thinking of ways to add value to the produce that you have on the farm. So that could be... it's sort of simply, and this is quite a trite thing to say, but it's about producing bread, not wheat. And probably more completely than that, it's about producing an experience of the food for the people you are giving it to, rather than just producing a commodity product that could be produced to the same quality standards anywhere in the world, really, but at much lower cost.
Okay.
And there's also the opportunity to get those people involved in there's value add within the food bit, but there's also the opportunity to get those people involved in non-food value add to the business.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be diversification schemes, including developing buildings or allowing people to have an experience of the countryside in some way through, you know, recreational activities or whatever. I suppose I don't really have, you know, it's not a clear answer for they're going to stop doing this and they're going to start doing this. The challenge I have for farmers is complaining about this stuff is not going to stop it happening.
Mm-hmm.
And whether Small Robot Company is going to be a huge success or whether it folds in the next 12 months is not going to stop robotics and AI having an enormous impact on the way we farm.
Mm.
So the challenge is it is happening, and the opportunity is to ask yourself the question, what is it that my farm and my team are uniquely able to do? And that could be about where you're geographically located. It could be about the skills and experiences that you have within the team. But what is it that you can do that can't easily be replicated by other people?
Mm.
And then the bits that can easily be replicated by other people, I would suggest you automate through the use of machinery, and start thinking about the value that you bring to your farm in a different way.
Mm.
That would be my challenge.
Okay. Do you ever wonder that they're going to murder you in your sleep? The robots? Does that...
No.
No.
it's not a dream or a worry that I have. Maybe it will be now that you've planted it in my head. No, I think this stuff... So the way I talk about this, so when electricity first came into the world, yeah. people were terrified of it.
Yeah.
People were terrified of this unseen thing that traveled around the house all the time and you never knew where it was or what it was doing or how it behaved. But actually, we quite enjoy living in a world that's got electricity.
Mm.
And I think in the same way, people are terrified about robotics and they're terrified about artificial intelligence. But my prediction is that it will become like electricity. And we will not be able to imagine what the world was like before we had it. And we'll actually thoroughly enjoy living in a world that has this technical capability.
Yeah.
It's scary now, and I do get that.
Mm-hmm.
But Hollywood has quite a bit to answer for, I think, in terms of how we think about this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think the future is going to be better than the past.
Mm.
I've always thought that, and I continue to think that, and it just provides different opportunities. We're not going into a world where there is less opportunities, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the opportunities we had in the past are exactly the same as the ones we're going to have in the future.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you've only got to look at our grandfathers and our great grandparents when they'd farmed for generations with
exactly.
horses, and then they saw the first motorized vehicles. I mean, it's no different, is it? They could never have envisioned how that would have changed the world.
No. They can, no, exactly.
Okay, so we're going to start to wrap this up because I know you're busy. So we will end this with the quick quiz, if you are ready. Hard-hitting questions,
yep,
as always.
Away.
All-time
favorite. Think of any answers.
All-time favorite song.
My head now.
What are you going for?
All-time favorite song.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be loyal to the first band that I ever saw live, and I'm going to say Girl from Mars by Ash.
Oh, that's a great choice. I used to love Ash. I saw them several times live back in the 90s.
Yeah,
brilliant choice. Great album. Okay, if you could be
really good album.
International standard at any sport, what would you go for?
I'm going to go for the most unrealistic one, having just watched the Ryder Cup over the weekend. I would love to be able to stand in front of 8,000 people or whatever it was on the first tee and do anything other than just go to mush. I'd love to be just even a little bit better at golf than I am.
Yeah, that's a very good choice. Okay, so when the smash sci-fi blockbuster Small Robot Company the movie comes out, who's playing you?
I'm gonna have someone ruggedly handsome but intensely thoughtful at the same time. I'm maybe like Jeremy Renner's character from Arrival.
Okay.
Remember that nuclear physicist or whatever he is.
Yeah. Okay.
Someone like that, or maybe like a sort of someone quite enigmatic, like a Mark Strong or something like that.
Okay.
More hair. I've got a bit more hair than Mark, but.
Okay. So, what's your idea?
Someone like that.
What's your idea of a perfect Sunday?
So I've got three kids now. The eldest one is not yet four. So family life is pretty chaotic. And we were talking about this the other day, like, what did we used to do on Sundays? I can't remember how we filled the day. I suppose now my perfect realistic Sunday is that I somehow miraculously wake up 30 or 45 minutes before my kids, and I get that time to just have a coffee and read the Sunday paper.
Yeah.
And then I just happily immerse myself in the chaos of three kids running around the place.
Yeah, I guess your perfect Sunday is similar to mine. All right, then. Lastly, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in the agricultural industry to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
I'm not, as you've probably seen from the difficulty of getting hold of me, well, I'm not a brilliant one on social media, actually, but of the people I do follow, I would recommend probably Tom Haddon, who I think is on as Farmer Tom. I think he is something like that. Who's
Tom Martin?
Tom Martin.
Yeah.
That's it. Sorry, Tom Martin at Haddon Farm. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Apologies. And he's just very thoughtful about the future of farming. We've had some really interesting discussions with him. He's doing some really interesting stuff. He's done FaceTime a farmer.
Yeah.
He's organising the East of England Farming Conference.
Mm-hmm.
Just a very thoughtful guy who doesn't always think that the future of farming is going to be exactly the same as the past.
No,
I'd follow him.
I like Tom a lot. Yeah, he's a similar kind of background to yours, actually, isn't he? Worked away from the farm for a few years, and he's got a bit of a different perspective, isn't he? He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy. All right then, Tam. Well, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today. It's been like a glimpse into the future.
Hopefully so. Yeah. Hopefully so. Robots coming to a farm near you very soon.
And good luck for the next few years. I'm sure the whole industry will be watching with growing interest. And everyone at home, thanks for listening and see you next time. If you're feeling generous, please give this episode a share or a retweet on social media. And if you feel like leaving the podcast a review on iTunes, that's a big help. If you make it funny, I might even read it out on a future podcast. Also, the podcast has now been downloaded in 83 different countries, would you believe? And I've given a shout out to one every week. Wow. This time it's the Netherlands. Big hello if you're listening over there. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.